Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Wow, what an episode we have for y'all today.
I know, what a great episode. We are joined by journalist, podcaster, podcast producer, and technically filmmaker as well now, Yael Evan Orr.
Yes, you're very close. It's Yael Evan Orr.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, you heard it here first.
That's her name, everybody, and she's saying it. Stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hello, everyone. This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hello, everyone. This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi.
Oh, that's our guest. There she is. I met this person a couple years ago at a random poetry reading. And for whatever reason, we followed each other on social media and kept in touch that way. We have Yael Evan Orr with us today, and I'm very excited to talk to her. She's a journalist. She's a podcast maker, an audio person that I'm sure she can explain better than that intro. Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you. I will say I didn't read any poetry that day.
Oh, yeah. You were hosting. It was at your house.
Yeah. And I did an audio storytelling piece about me getting nutrients through an IV, which was kind of a very silly thing. And you were reading this great poetry.
So
it's very much I was on the lowbrow side.
No, it wasn't. There were a lot of comedians. So my poem was very depressing in comparison. It was
there were some funny people actually.
Yeah, there were very funny people. You're in New York right now, right?
Yes. So we met when I was in LA, but in June of 2019, I moved back to New York where I've lived before. Oh. So I've been here for my second round for 2 years now.
Did you move because of work or just because you prefer New York, which I also do?
I really loved LA, but I couldn't see myself staying there in the long term because it's so far away from my family. I lived in New York for about 6 years before. So it was the closest to being home in the US.
Yeah. Well, let's get into that. Let's rewind a little bit. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
So I was born in Tel Aviv, Israel. I grew up there. You know, I didn't grow up in the city so much. It was kind of a neighborhood sort of on the outskirts of the city. So it was a little suburban, basically. Mm-hmm. And I lived in Tel Aviv until I was 27. And then I moved to the U.S. Yeah, I've never been to the U.S. before I've moved here. So
wow. And your whole family moved? Or was it you?
Yeah. It was just me. I came here to do my master's degree on a student visa. You know, I think I was hoping to stay, but I also didn't really know what to expect. I wasn't thinking really long term. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to take the opportunity to be, you know, abroad for 2 years and see what happens. And I ended up staying for 9 years now.
Wow. What led you to stay? Just opportunity?
Not really, because there were times where, you know, I didn't have a job and I didn't have a visa. Now I have a green card, but for years it was always the struggle of where the next visa is going to come from.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would go back and forth kind of on going back to Israel, and I would just be like, I'll give myself a few more months and see if something works out. Yeah, I think part of it is professional, really. And at some point, you know, I started being an audio producer. And at that point, it's such an undeveloped field back home that I couldn't really do what I do. Mm-hmm. As a journalist as well, I worked in journalism in Israel, and I don't think there's a lot of outlets that do what I want to do. And, you know, have the perspective that I wanted to have. So after a while here, it's like, can I find myself there again? Yeah. Even though I miss my friends and family terribly. And it's always a question in the back of your mind of should I be here or there? Especially at times like COVID, you know, when everything feels so fragile. But yeah.
So when you said closer to family, you just meant closer as a flight.
Yeah.
Okay. Just making sure.
Well, I have one cousin also in Montreal, so I guess that way I'm closer to her. But yes, it's from LA. It's over 15-hour flight.
Yeah. Trust me, we both understand. Yeah, Anna exactly. goes to Iran. I've been to Syria. It's like 18 hours. If you have layovers, it's a whole struggle.
Yeah. And if something goes wrong, like one time a flight was leaving late and we didn't get to the connecting final time, this is like 48 more hours that I had to wait in like order mm-hmm. to get on the next flight. When you're in New York, you're like flights leaving, I don't know, 3-5 times a day. Yeah. So it's just like knowing that if something happens and I need to go right away, I can, which I never had in LA, which I'm sure you understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. How long is that flight from New York?
It's like almost 11 hours. Getting back is a little longer, like 12. But
that's
yeah,
basically 10, like 30. Driving. Yeah, it's like driving to Northern California or like Portland or something. That's totally doable as a flight.
It's much more doable, yeah.
Can you go direct?
Yes, from New York.
Wow, a luxury. Yes. When it comes to international travel.
Yeah. Only in the last couple of years, I started flying direct. Before that, I would stop in like anywhere.
Just to save money, right?
Yeah. 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 It's like I would go, I would find flights for like less than $500 in my first years here as a student with like a stop in Russia. I did a lot of Russia and Ukraine, actually.
Mm, that's cool.
Is that on the way?
No.
Okay, but it's probably way cheaper. I feel like,
It's not on the way. But it doesn't make it as much longer for some reason. Mm-hmm. But it's not really on the way, no. It's only 4 hours away from there, around 4 hours. So you go there, you know, spend the night in a airport in Moscow and then fly home.
Yeah. I always forget how so many cities in Europe and like Asia, like just like that part of the world are closer than I imagine.
Yeah.
Like the fact that you said it's a 4 hour, like Moscow to Tel Aviv is 4 hours. Like that blew my mind. Like in my head, they're just so far away.
I think it's far. I should check to make sure, but that's how I remember it. So yeah. And so it's a lot of connecting flights for Europe as well.
So does your family ever come to New York or did they ever come to LA to visit you?
Yes. They came to LA once. Actually, my dad was like, I'm not going to do it again because the flight, because it's too far.
Yeah.
And that was part of a reason too, is like allowing them to visit more.
Yeah.
But I think on average, I would say like a member of my family, whether it's my parents or my sister, will come visit on average every other year or something
like
that. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
My parents were just supposed to come and because of like COVID, cases have just went up so much in the last couple of weeks that they just canceled.
Yeah. What was it like growing up in Tel Aviv? And did you always know you wanted to pursue some type of journalistic job?
No, I didn't know. I'm not even sure when it kind of started. I mean, I think I was flirting with it for a while, but I didn't know journalists growing up. My parents had like a very corporate jobs of like an engineer, and my mom worked in like finance departments. And that's kind of like parents of people I grew up with would do these kind of jobs and less in the creative field.
Right.
So
right.
I really didn't think I had access to it. It wasn't like something we learned at school as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it was kind of a dream because I liked writing, but I wasn't necessarily, I didn't feel like I could actually do it. Maybe when I was 22, I remember getting involved with this like journalistic project as sort of like really assistant or producer. And it was this like a nonprofit that someone started to try to do like kind of a democratic form of journalism. But, you know, I got involved in it in a very unimportant role because I think I did want to be close to journalists. And it's only a few years after that I was able to get a job as a news editor in like a news website. At the time, I felt like I couldn't believe my luck.
Right.
And like that I got to that without connections and all that. It's a big news website and it still exists, but it's the one that's been more in the news recently as it played like a pretty significant role in like Netanyahu's corruption case. So for a while after, they're actually getting directions and instructions on how to cover the prime minister.
All propaganda. I mean, it's honestly the same thing here. It's just less obvious sometimes.
Overt.
Yeah, less overt.
That was very overt. Like, I mean, it's so overt that there's a whole criminal case, you know. So yeah, that was how I started.
I think it's sad because both Anna and I were also interested in like artistic jobs and just like a life. And when you don't see that modeled anywhere, you don't think it's possible. Like when everyone around you is doing something different or like you don't see yourself represented as anything other than like going to college and going to grad school or whatever it is, heavy relate to that feeling. Yeah, for sure.
I worked in HR before, actually. So I just felt like, oh, that's like a profession. I mean, that's like something I need to pursue.
A real job, in quotes.
Yeah. I mean, I was also a student, but yeah. And I think, you know, I spent actually 6 months in Germany through like a student exchange program. And that kind of gave me some courage to really pursue something that I was more interested in and more creative and something that I thought belonged to like smarter people. Mm-hmm. And kind of like just, I was, you know, I just started hitting people that I don't really know up to like, hey, can I give you my resume to send to this place. And that's kind of how it worked out. But I needed, you know, I was 25, which is when I came to the interview, the news director, who was a very rude person at the time, he was like, you're 25. Like, what makes you think you can be a journalist now? Oh. Like, it's too late for you.
What?
Basically.
You're not like a Olympic gymnast. Relax. Sorry, you can only learn to read at 18. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
I think specifically, well, I think it exists here to some degree because a lot of people are going to like, you know, journalism kind of projects at their college and they're like the editor-in-chiefs of their newspaper, right? But in Israel, I think the version of that is that there is a very big radio station in Israel that belongs to the military. And some people are getting recruited to the military. And if they're like, you know, go through a lot of tests and they have to prove they're really smart and talented, and then they go to the station and they serve there. So a lot of Israeli journalists actually started there at that military station. And I wasn't that person. So for me to come at 25 when he's like, all these other people, you know, started at 18 was like, I mean, I'm not justifying him. It was very rude thing to say, but I still got the job. So
that's surreal. It's such like a strict mandate of like, this is how it's done. And if you don't do it that way, unfortunately, you're a lost cause. When it's like, it's just like reading, like having critical thought and reporting. It's not like you can't go walk up to someone and like ask them a question.
Yes. Surreal. And also that job was like news editor, which is like there. And then it was kind of like at the bottom of the poll of like, you know, you kind of, I mean, you're not even going out to report. You kind of just need, you really need to have like language skills and some like news instincts. And that's basically enough.
Yeah. You mentioned like you had a different perspective from news outlets. And I'm curious if that influenced you going to New York, or I'm sure in America too, you had like a student visa and then maybe you were pressured to like find a job right away to get a work visa. So that's a separate question, I suppose. But was that related to the move?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just a lot of things that were at a certain point really hard for me to do as a journalist in Israel. I'm not saying, I mean, there is at least one outlet that doesn't do all these things automatically, which is the Aretz, which isn't one newspaper. But for the most part, if you work in Israeli media, you're getting like press releases from the IDF, for example, and you kind of just take them as is. And if there's a war or any like event that is like, you know, if it's not like the routine, what is the routine for Israelis or Jewish Israelis? I mean, that's when media is kind of becoming, you know, very, very mouthpiecey of like the government and the military. And of course, it has shades and nuances. I mean, the example that I think about a lot because it's so small and so routine is that when I worked at the news website, we would do an overnight shift, like the junior news editors, where you just need to work the whole night. And it's terrible, of course, any job. It's really hard. And, you know, you have a certain number of like stories you have to put up during the night. So you have like the big stories, and then you have something that I'm not sure how to call it in English, but it's very common in Israeli news websites. You have like this scroll with like short, short
bullet points,
headlines. Like the, yes, with like short. It's, I think in Israel, it's like such a common thing. It's like a very, you know, place that consumes a lot of news. I don't really see it here as much. So it's like something comes, when something happens, like right away, you'll see that bullet point before you have a full story. So as a news editor during the night, you kind of have to like meet a certain quota. Like when someone comes to pick you up to like replace you in the morning, you like show that you did something. And I think it was like every hour you need to put up two of these bullet points. So for the most part, you're sitting on this like Reuters feed and you're like in Indonesia, like all of a sudden you get very, and actually that's where I think I started really fell in love with like international news, because you just, you have to explore what happens in other time zones, like stuff on like the Burmese border and like stuff like that. But you're like really starving for these updates some nights. And every morning at about 5 or 6 a.m., like the IDF is sending a press release, or maybe you are supposed to call the IDF and they're like giving you the press release. I can't remember. And it's just what they teach you, like do this every, right, you know, every day at 5 or 6 a.m. And they tell you how many suspects they captured that night in the West Bank, which is basically operation that the IDF is doing in the West Bank. You know, every night goes into houses. I think there was like kind of in people's homes and arrest people. So it's how many arrests they do over the night. Of course, they use language that is like suspects, terrorists. Mm-hmm. Like the, it makes it sound like they actually captured people who are planning the next like big, you know, terrorist attack.
Yeah,
right.
You know, if anyone is following this a little bit, we know that this practice is very, very problematic and involves children a lot of time.
Yeah.
And actually, I think even lately there was some development there. It's like Israel or the IDF acknowledging that they kind of need to stop doing it or just stop at least some parts of it. I didn't read up on it enough. Sorry.
Maybe just making it less obvious.
Yeah. So we would just get this and it's like, you know, we would just take it as is, like they would dictate to us exactly. And you would just release it as this bullet point. You don't even think about it. Like this is, it's 5 a.m. You worked all night. That's what your senior editor told you to do. Like you do this thing every day. All news outlets, you would see it in like all the news outlets in Israel, even ours. Like everyone would like put this up at the same time. And, you know, for us, it's like it's a free story because you have to meet the quota. And, you know, I think until I spent like a year or two here in the US, I wasn't like I never really questioned like who are these people who got arrested? Like, why am I using the IDF language for like them being suspects or terrorists? You know, like, are they really suspected of doing anything? Mm-hmm. Because really we know now that they're like, oh, I guess some people knew then as well, just not me, that this is like more of an intelligence operation where they take people from their homes in a very disruptive way. And then they like interrogating them for the most part, but they made it sound like it's like they did something or they're about to do something.
Right.
And we just used their exact language and did it. This is such a tiny example. Like this is so banal. I mean, this is not about how you cover things when there's like wartime attacks on Gaza. This is just a normal everyday thing. And I think once it hit me that there's a lot of small examples like that, or how you have to ask the IDF, like you have to go to the censorship and ask for approval if you want to publish things about the IDF. There's no place to like, you know, ask questions about who these people are, talk to some representative of Palestinians and ask. I mean, you know, I'm not even expecting the Israelis to not have the perspective of Israelis. This is really where you're not even doing the bare minimum of like journalism, you know, when you take that. So yeah, as far as working in Israel, that's kind of that is kind of the thing that, you know, was keeping me here for years and like actually moving back and trying to pursue journalism there. I did move back a couple of years after to do election coverage for a couple of months when there was election in 2015. Uh-huh. And I think actually weirdly election coverage is a little bit less contentious in that it's kind of like a horse race, you know. Uh-huh. But you know, I had issues back then as well, and my boss at the time kind of knew that if something, you know, if there's another war or anything like that, I'm gonna have to leave, because was really weird for me to working for like a mainstream news outlet in a time like that.
Yeah. So like your perspective about at least even hearing the Palestinians' perspective, or like trying to be just standing up for Palestine anyway, that you have to leave the country. You can't even report about that.
You know, there are some alternative news media. I mean, there is Local Call, which is the like Hebrew version of 972, if people know it. It's not mainstream media. It's still a niche in Israel. And then you have Haaretz, which is a relatively lefty newspaper that still allows some of this like other perspectives and views, and trying to get both sides more. And I think, you know, in the last, what we've seen in a few months ago, that they were doing by far the best, because I was in Israel at the time. They were doing by far the best work as far as like trying to like talk to people on the other side, quote unquote. So,
right.
Yeah, I think as a journalist, it's really hard. I mean, I think if I was like a software engineer, I could probably, you know, have my opinions and still do my work without, unless you work for, you know, a company that's helping you know, do something kind of military, mm-hmm. whatever. There's a lot of companies that work with the military as well.
Of course, yeah.
So it really depends. I think some people are able to find, you know, ways to kind of distance themselves from working very directly for kind of that like dominant view of, mm-hmm. you know, of the occupation is fine, basically. Yeah. Yeah.
So I have a question. You said this briefly, like if you want to report anything about the IDF, you have to get it approved by them?
Yeah. So there is like a department in the IDF that is like the censorship, basically. Oh. And every time you want to report, I mean, it's illegal for you to not ask for their permission. So I'm, you know, unless anything changed, maybe there are some loopholes, but as far as I know, every time we had to publish something about the IDF, and as far as I know how it works today, you have to ask for their permission. So you'll send them the story and they'll tell you like what to deduct, what you can't use. And you know, that's why, by the way, a lot of time in Israel, when you want to say, for example, Israel attacked in Syria, even Israeli reporters who might have that like information from their sources, we always say, it's kind of a joke, but you always say like according to foreign sources. So you have to go to the New York Times to say the New York Times said it, because we can't say it ourselves, even though we probably know it better than the New York Times, but legally we're not allowed to say it. And, you know, those things are well documented. Like there's a reason why, you know, Freedom of Press Index is always putting Israel like not in a great place. A lot of it is like largely due to the like military press relationship.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Well, it's just all these little manipulations that just, you don't even, it like glosses over, you know? And and somehow it's just built in to the way it works.
Yeah, and it's sad because that's why people don't really learn, don't get the full picture. And if they don't speak good English, which a lot of them don't, because it's not our native language, like they just might really not get the full picture. You know, of course, like if you really wanted to, you can, especially now with the internet. So I never know how much to put the responsibility, because like you can find those alternative sources as well. But if you open the TV, if you just get like the, you know, the biggest newspaper, all of that, like especially in war times, you're just not getting the other side.
If that's the only thing you're exposed to and it's like been indoctrinated in a way. Let's take our first commercial break and we'll be right back.
We are back. So when you travel back and forth, like based off what I've read about people who have just been hassled going into Israel, like do you ever face any sort of scrutiny, or because you were like born and raised there, I mean, lived there for the, you know, a good amount of your life, like are you able to come and go like unscathed?
Yeah, I've never faced any scrutiny. I think if you're born there and you're Jewish and your document said that, because you have Jewish on your ID as well. It was never an issue for me, to be honest. And I remember a time where I was like more vocal about my views and there was some concern, but I actually don't think anything happened. I will say that, you know, my husband, he's a white American with actually a Jewish name, even though he's not Jewish. And he faces a lot of questions. He doesn't have an Arab name. He never traveled to Syria. Like, he doesn't have all these things that makes it so much harder for you to get in. He's just an American guy. But, you know, he just gets more questioning, basically. And I think last time there was even, like, some questions about, are you going to convert to Judaism? And I don't actually know why they ask him that, because there is no security. I mean, I can't imagine what kind of security excuse you can attach to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe they're just being judgmental of our relationship. I don't know.
Well, you're gonna convert to Judaism. It's like, what are you, my dad? Get out of here.
Yeah. It's almost them saying, like, are you gonna come to our side in their way? I wanna go back to you a little bit. So you're in New York, so you're gonna graduate soon. What job are you looking for, and how did you end up trying to stay for longer than you did, or longer than like your visa allowed?
So yes, when I was about to graduate, I think I was kind of stretching my degree, to be honest, because first I needed more time to write my thesis and I was always working, but also because, you know, it's like more time on my visa to figure out what's happening. At the time I was already working as a journalist in Israel, but as you know, it's like when you move to a different country, you kind of have to start all over again in some ways. So it was kind of clear that I'm not going to get a job right, right away. I had an internship at the time at the Jewish Daily Forward. I've actually published like radio pieces throughout my years as a student in like some big publication as a freelancer. But, you know, no one was actually calling me back for job interviews at all. Mm-hmm. So that was when they announced like emergency election in Israel, which happens a lot. And my former editor asked me if I want to come for like 3 months just to cover the campaign. And so that's when I took the offer and I went back. And it was a time when I wasn't sure I'll be back in New York. And after I did that, there is something you get when you finish a degree, when you finish your degree and you're on a student visa, you get something called OPT, which is like 1 year to work. So it's kind of like, okay, we'll let you come here. And now we understand that you want to maybe try to stay here. You get a year.
Right. Figure it out in 1 year or you're
out. 1 year you can get a job and you're amazing and they like sponsor you and all that. You can stay. If not, you're going back home. I know so many people who went back home.
Well, yeah, because it's one thing to get a job, but they have to sponsor you. You know what I mean? That those are not always two given things when you get a job.
And they have to be okay with you like having this OPT only for 1 year. So you might have to leave in a year unless they sponsor you, which they also never want to do. Yeah. Unless, well, I'll tell you about my case, but so, you know, I was basically like 4 months into my OPT in Israel. Actually had a pretty good time there at the time. And, you know, was offered to stay there. Also, like, keep working for the news website and, like, kind of range of positions that I can. And I was thinking about, you know, this is maybe my time to actually be a reporter and report on things I want to do. But something in me was just, like, not really, wasn't ready to let go of the idea of trying to use this year that was at that point 8 or 9 months.
Yeah.
And like try to really build something in the US. And, you know, I was already pretty hooked on audio. Mm-hmm. So that, which is something I only got to know in the US. Yeah. I decided to come back. I, again, had no job, had really nothing going on for me, but I was renting a really cheap room in Washington Heights. So that kind of allowed me to try to figure it out. And I was just trying to work on keep applying to jobs and, you know, freelance pieces for public radio for the most part. I, at some point in this year, I got a grant to go. I was able to get a grant to go to Zimbabwe for about 5 or 6 weeks and do an investigative story about an Israeli company there that was rumored to help Mugabe rig the elections.
Oh, wow.
So I went there. Also, the grant was pretty, I mean, the story was hard to do, but also just resources wise, but I really wanted to do that story.
Yeah.
The question, by the way, the answer is, I mean, I invite people to read it, but it's that I don't know if they helped me rig it or not. I mean, that it's like, there was no smoking gun at the end of the day. I mean, and probably they didn't help him direct. I mean, there wasn't like a real rigging situation going on, but there's definitely a lot of ties that are not super legit and not really okay. And it's like, it really goes to like questions of like trust in election system and for, you know, involvement of foreign companies and elections in other countries and a lot of interesting questions. So I did that. I think I did some research on a documentary that I never got paid for. So a lot of like small gigs like that. Yeah. And then it was again, the end of my OP. And again, I was in this position of like, I don't know how I can stay here. And last minute, I mean, really last minute before I just gave up and went back to Israel, I found a job. I mean, I decided to kind of expand my search beyond New York, which was smart because New York is very competitive. And I found a job in a public radio show that was based out of D.C. Okay. And they actually didn't need me to move to D.C. I could just work remotely. Nice. And I also came to them with kind of the idea that, you know, I have a plan for a visa. I'm going to pay for everything. It was a very expensive process. I just need them to like sign the document that I'm going to work for them. So I'll do the whole visa thing myself. And that's how I ended up staying. And that, you know, that was the first job that really launched my pretty much working full time in audio sense. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other jobs I found through people I already worked with. But this one was kind of pretty random, but I had a master's degree in international affairs and they were looking for someone who actually had knowledge about international affairs because it was a very wonky, like international affairs heavy show. And I emailed them many times
and one of them worked.
Yeah.
Like one of the emails worked. That's incredible.
Yeah.
You made it happen.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So that's how I ended up staying. And I mean, I think every time I left a job or there was some change, there was a moment like that of like, I'm not even sure I'm going to stay. I mean, even when I moved to LA, it was kind of like that. You know, a visa was running out and I need a new job and I'm not sure. And I mean, only now in the last year or two, I'm more in a place of, you know, I live here, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not my whole, maybe I want to live here my whole life, but I'm here. I have a green card. I married an American. But, you know, for years it was always this.
Yeah. It's so stressful. That's so stressful.
That's the classic American way.
Mm-hmm.
You just never know how it's going to turn out. And you have to just keep hustling until you can figure it out. Even when you live here. It's not great.
Yeah, it was definitely, I mean, and every visa just in itself, I mean, I can talk about it so much. I actually have a friend in LA who did the whole like art show when we were on the same visa and you have to submit like a 700 page folder, basically. And all the pages should say how extraordinary you are and how amazing you are. So you deserve to stay.
That's so weird.
She did this show and she was just like for 24 hours, she was standing in the room on this like pile of papers and she's just reading the whole thing or something like, maybe it was a little less, but yeah, I mean, it was like, I mean, it was very expensive. The lawyers would deal with those kind of requests. And then, you know, you have to do a lot of gathering yourself and it's a lot of like pulling favors of like, you know, asking people to write. I mean, the lawyers write them.
But still, it's all a scam.
It's like, Elle is the most amazing journalist I've ever seen. And it's just, it's so awkward. And it is really odd, too. Like, you just have to show
that you're deserving.
Worthy,
like, it's so disgusting to me.
Yeah. So that's how I got my green card as well, like on the same category. And it was, it's very weird. I mean, though, with the green card process, it was after Trump took office and he signed all these executive orders to change the process. For the first time for this process, they actually added an interview, which was, you know, very stressful because it just started and no one knew. Like, my lawyers didn't know. They're like, we never dealt with an interview for this process, so we don't know what they're going to do. And we don't know if they, like, I was, you know, before that, I was already approved.
Yeah.
I mean, before Trump, I was supposed to be already approved. Like, everything was working. But then they added this interview, and I was actually in LA at the time. And I remember going to this interview, and the guy interviewing me was very cold and questioning.
Wow.
And there was, like, very anxious moment of, like, I might not get it, especially seeing your own lawyers freak out over, like, what's going to happen.
Well, you would think that you're a demographic that they wouldn't question. You're white. You're from Israel. Like, it's the fact that you had a hard time, I could only imagine my family went through a very weird process. Like, so many of my family members. And just all a fucking scam. I hate the U.S.
Yeah, part of me is like, I feel like that's how they tell them to be. Like, they're like, you need to be like a stone cold killer in there, even though it's like, why? Who cares? Like, you'll know right away if you shouldn't give someone
that's
a green
true.
Card. Like, one, you look at their record, like what they've been up to. And if it's like, this person seems to only commit crimes. Okay, well, let's see why. Okay, like, it's just like takes a little bit of critical thinking versus like, this person just wants to live and work and be a journalist. And you're like, what are you up to?
Yeah.
It's like, they're not.
I mean,
okay, maybe this is a stretch and I will move on. But like, maybe they realize like, she's outspoken about Palestine in the past or something. And they're like, we can't have that because we're best friends with Israel. That's
my theory.
I actually
don't think they're that sophisticated.
Yeah,
but I think you're right that actually I mean, the fact that it was such a stressful experience for me, and I'm like probably in the most privileged group of immigrants, like, you know, not only being white, non-threatening their ideas of danger in any way. Like, I'm from Israel, which is like, it's like very easy for me. So it's always like, you know, thinking like how it must be for others and how crazy it can get. And it's, you know, like the month of just like waiting for answers to and not knowing and being in the space of like, I might just have to leave, you know, soon. Yeah. And it's like, I already built a life here. So it's, I mean, it's very stressful and I can't imagine how it is for others. Like I barely bring it up because I feel like my experience is actually so smooth.
No, but it's still like, so anxiety inducing. Like, you built a life and then you're forced to move. I had a friend that had to move back home to Sweden after building a whole life here and like going, like, just for, I knew her for years and like suddenly she's back in Sweden. And I'm just like, wow.
Because she couldn't get a green card?
She had a work visa and it expired and she, like, the time was coming up and she had nothing to, to let her stay here. And it's just so stressful to have your entire existence and like your environment decided by some irrelevant powers that be that scam people out of their money. It's so stupid. Because it's also implying that you have to like spend a lot of money to stay. Like, if you're not able to cover that fee, you're fucked. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, the fees associated, I mean, there are fees associated with the actual request to USCIS, to the Immigration Authority. But it's like, there's so many cases in which I think like you're kind of told, you know, if you're not going to have a good lawyer, you're just not going to get the visa or the green card. So you're like kind of forced to pay a lawyer, which is where the really high fees are kicking out. Like, it took me, I think, a year to pay off. I had to put it on my credit cards and I think it took me more than a year to pay those off.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still like such a hassle just to come to this country, like come here and then like we won't even give you like healthcare. Like, good luck. You'll good luck trying to like go to a doctor. We'll make it as difficult as possible. Aren't you glad you went through all that to come here? By the way, the cops will shoot at you. No big deal. They are technically here to protect you, but that's a lie. Why would they protect you? You know, nothing matters. Also, here's debt. It's just like, what is the point anymore? We gotta find a new place. This is not
working. We
gotta
find a new place. We really do. Invent our own island or something.
I know. And every year they're like, oh, and you know what? We actually need more money because we have to give weapons to this country. And you're like, why? Yeah. Like, what is going on? Why?
Yeah.
And
Do you have family members who like came here and then came back?
No, my parents are the only people in their family that came to America, and they came in the like 70s, like mid 70s. And like they came to go to college, and it was just like before the Iranian Revolution happened. So there was like no, you know, there wasn't the hostage situation had it happened. There was like the Shah was still in charge. So, you know, of course, him and America had a great relationship because he was just, you know, feeding off that teat, if you will.
Yeah.
So he, I mean, it was just smooth sailing for them, but like, we would bring my grandma here, my mom's mom, to visit. Like, so she would come and stay for like 4 months at a time. And like, really, my parents never discussed this with me if they actually planned to try and keep my grandma here. But I just remember it always being like a very long visa process to just get her to visit, which, you know, shouldn't be the case because my parents are now both, you know, at the time had already become citizens, like had been long citizens when they were bringing my grandma over in the 90s, you know. And it got to where my grandma, who's, you know, like getting older, was like, I don't want to keep doing this. You come visit me. Like, I can't keep coming back to America and then like hanging out in a world where I don't know anyone because I'm also just like an old Persian lady. So people aren't necessarily dying to speak to me. And like, I'm just hanging around with a bunch of like elementary school kids. I mean, she stopped coming around when I was in junior high, but like, you know, it's like us just like harassing her and annoying her and like running around and being like, bah! And so to her, she was like, this isn't worth it anymore. Like, this whole visa process, like, also, like, I'm old and I have to travel by myself to the US, which is from Iran. Of course, you know, the journey that it takes. Like, I think it just became clear, like, no one else in my family, like, wanted to deal with that. Like, I had a cousin who came to visit and it took him like a year to get a visa. And then his mom, it took her like 3 years to get a visa to come visit. So like, it's just like, after a while, you're like, you know what? I'll go to Europe. I don't want to come to America. Like, or I'll go to Australia. It's just too hard to try and get here. It's just so much, you know, bureaucracy.
Yeah. My family went through a very difficult process. Like, so my parents were the only ones to come here from their family initially in like the early 80s. Through a very long process, they eventually became citizens. But shortly after they came here, my mom's family and my dad's family, like some of my uncles, I have a very big family. So like two of my uncles on my mom's side, eventually two of my uncles on my dad's side also. But my mom's brothers stayed here on a visa. They had an amazing time. They really wanted to stay. And that was after they had applied for them. And it, like, they were able to come after like a year and a half. one of my uncles overstayed the visa and they eventually found out and kicked him out. And he wasn't able to return for 10 years. Like, they didn't even let him apply again. And it finally went through after 10 years after, like, just convincing someone to be nice. And yeah, like, my whole family, like, my mom was trying to get her family to stay here for, like, literally, like, a decade and a half. And it finally happened, like, literally 5 years ago. Like, it's just so depressing. Because that's a whole, like, chunk of your life that you're waiting for the stupid country to let you in. And, like, the other uncle that did overstay the visa, he loved America. He was, like, as much as, like, this is silly, like, he was my cowboy uncle. Like, he was the person that was obsessed with America, would wear cowboy hats, little bandana on his neck, who's just the best. He had to leave on the visa, and he wasn't able to come back for 10 years. He wasn't even kicked out, but the process of even getting a visa took so many years, like, another attempt. And again, my parents became citizens eventually, and that didn't fucking help at all. So it's just, like, heartbreaking. I mean, like, and now I have a couple of family members that came here during the war, and they had, like, essentially became citizens through, like, a refugee status in a way. Yeah. Or they're not even citizens yet. Like, my aunt is one, but I have a big family, sorry. But the point is, they make it excruciating to even attempt to live here. And I think it's so fucked up that they don't even realize how much 10 years of your life can be. It's just heartbreaking. On that note, on that very happy note, let's take our second break and we'll be right back. Okay. You mentioned you worked in audio, like, when you were in college, and I imagine that was before podcasting had a big boom. So how did you stick with doing this audio, like, a very niche audio thing for a while, and how did that evolve into podcasting?
Yeah, so I worked as a news editor, so I come from more, like, you know, websites, or, like, you know, that kind of evolution of print. And I went to do my master's degree in international affairs. To be honest, at the time, I wasn't necessarily trying to stay a journalist. I thought I'll be more in academia. And so that's kind of my way to, like, going to a PhD later. But I had a professor that kind of pushed me to take more, like, practical classes. And, you know, my second semester, I actually, for some reason, I was missing, like, a credit. Maybe a class was canceled, a course was canceled. And then they sent us an email about this new class that just opened. And I just read it pretty quickly. It says, Feet in Two Worlds. And it said something about immigrants and journalism. And I, like, signed up, because I was like, I'm an immigrant, I'm a journalist. And so I went to this class, and I didn't know it at the time, but apparently it's part of, like, this organization that was sitting in the new school, like, in the university I went to, and was trying to get immigrants to have stories on public radio. But, you know, when I went to the class and they were talking about radio, I was very disengaged. Like, I come from, like I said, like, one of the most popular, I mean, two of the most popular stations, I guess, in Israel are kind of, you know, like, military stations. And I think, you know, the conception at the time was that, like, radio is a dying medium. Like, everything is on the internet. And I was, like, not interested in learning a new skill of, like, to work in a medium that is dying. Like, I don't need that. So I was, like, when we were starting to working on our stories, they said, if you really don't want to do audio, you can, like, just have a story for our website. So I'm like, yeah, that's what I'll do. And I actually did a story about a Syrian refugee. I think I was pretty, you know, this is 2013. And I was working in the newsroom when the uprising started in Syria. So I think every Friday, like, working in the newsroom, I mean, just being in Israel, you're kind of more engaged. Whatever your, like, you know, the perspective is, like, it's just as far as following what's happening in the Middle East. So Syria was very much something I would follow as far as, like, news. And at the time, I actually had a roommate who worked in Sahadi's, which is a great, like, Middle Eastern grocery store in Brooklyn. And through that connection, and I did a story, an audio story about them, actually, now that I think about it later. But through that connection, through her friend who worked there, who was from Syria, his sister just came to Syria. Her husband had to stay there. They're from Idlib area. And she gave birth in Brooklyn. And her husband, you know, they couldn't bring him here. So she was facing this dilemma whether to just go back to Syria in the middle of the civil war. so she can have her daughter, you know, her family united. And I interviewed her. Obviously, it was anonymous because she was kind of, you know, fearing her what will happen to her if she does go back to Syria. And she was really thinking about going back there. And I did the story for a class. And I think because some people in the public radio world knew that this project does work in radio, they approached me and approached my teacher and asked me to do a radio version of that. So I got an email from WNYC and from PRI's The World, like pretty good, you know, radio shows and radio stations. I had no idea who they were. But my teacher was basically like, you should do it. Like, this is big. Like, your first story in America, and they want you to get on like a national radio show. So I went back to her, and this time actually recording with a kit that they gave me. And I had to learn how to do audio. So, and then edit it. And, you know, I mean, we really went with a very simple form of a story for both of these stories. And one of them, like, they interview me, and I think I was so, I mean, I was just so anxious. And my accent was pretty thick then, too, I think. So anyway, I did those two radio stories, and I kind of fell in love with audio. I went to Sahadi's and actually did, like, an audio postcard on the store and the owner. And I just started, like, trying to do audio whenever I can. I was working on a master thesis about South Africa during transition period, and I kind of turned it into an audio documentary instead of a thesis. I still had a written component. But I really focused, like, my time in South Africa on actually interviewing people on, like, you know, getting good audio from them. And I kept doing, like, freelance stories mostly about immigrants. Like, I think I got particularly interested in immigrants that, like, you know, being here and then they see something big happening in their country and they feel very torn about being here while that was happening. And that's something, like, I experienced, obviously. I mean, I spent some time with some of the Syrian activist community in, I would say activists, people who were, you know, I mean, things have, like, got even more complicated since then.
But there was, like, a period where it was a very clear, like, rebellion activism thing. I remember that so well.
Yeah, exactly. It was pretty clear at the time. And I actually have still, I think I still have a lot of tapes of them that never, because I kept pitching the stories and they didn't, ended up, you know, getting placed for the most part. So I still have some really good tapes from the time that I would love to do something about. Like, I remember being, you know, with some big activists in New Jersey and Patterson, like the night that Obama was basically saying he's not going to do anything.
I remember that very well.
Everyone remembers that night in the Syrian community, right?
That was when I started to just, like, I was questioning Obama back then, but that's when I really was like, fuck. And I voted for him happily when I was 18. But that moment was when my entire family was like, fuck this guy.
Yeah. I mean, I still think about it as, like, a major moment for, like, at least, you know, that community that I knew from New York and like, all these opposition activists. It was like, a very devastating night. Like, they came to kind of celebrate, I think. So, and I went to demonstrations with them, and I have tapes of that. And, you know, I ended up doing a story for PRI's The World again about someone in Burundi and how we experienced seeing, like, a genocide happening there in the 90s. So, you know, I was really interested in this idea of immigrants being here while have to watch from afar. And then I got a full-time job in a show about international affairs. It was a little, it was kind of different first because I was a producer and less on the reporter side. And also because it was, like I said, it came out from DC. It had like a think tanky kind of vibe for the most part, talking to experts. And after that, I moved to LA to work at KCRW. And I also started with like a very political kind of show, again, producing daily. But even when I was there, I actually did still try to work on some of this issue. So I did a story with some Syrian activists in Orange County. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really do podcasting, though. But because I have, you know, I did have the tendency to want to do like field pieces. And I worked at some point at KCRW, I worked for Press Play with Madeline Brand, where there was some like room for experimenting with different kind of formats. That was like a good prep for moving into podcasting that, like, of course, at the time, it was already very big. But and by the way, not that I see, like, the difference between necessarily radio and podcasting. Like, it's kind of, you know, it's very similar things. I think the difference, the biggest difference for me is that I moved from working mainly in news and on daily shows to, like, now working in, like, narrative long-form projects that sometimes take, like, a year or two to make. And so when I moved to New York, I started working mostly with Audible on contracts. And with them, it's really much more like longer form projects. So, you know, like 6, 7, 8 episode. Not always. Like I worked on like kind of shorter projects, and they obviously do also like interview style shows. So it's really very eclectic. Like every project is very different. And the work has changed a lot, of course. And podcasting, like what's going on in podcasting right
now. It's ever evolving, really. Like, obviously last year was a huge boom in podcasting. But I do really appreciate that you as a journalist did reach out to those communities that like needed a voice. Because when you have access to like a platform, I don't know, even like KCRW, if you're like making an effort to just be a journalist and like talk to like Syrian refugees or whoever needs representation. I just really admire that because a lot of people just go, I think a lot of people forget what the word journalist means in a way. So I just appreciate you. Thank you.
Oh, sure. I think this like immigrant experience is something that I really just relate to. And I think with Syria specifically, I don't know. It's just this feeling of like, you know, as someone who did, I don't have relatives there like you do, and I can't imagine what it's like. But as someone who just followed the news,
it's heartbreaking.
From early on, it's like you just want to scream. Like and like I think, you know, when I did that story, I think the reason that it like picked up is because America, this is like what, probably two years into civil war. But America was finally catching up. Like all of a sudden they're like, oh, we need to talk about it. Like I think there was like really very little coverage up until then. I mean, and definitely not a lot of like, I don't think like kind of the human interest, you know, or like talking with people really. And it's like, there are a lot of people here that you can talk to actually and like get, you know, not only like the foreign policy experts to, not just to hear from them, but kind of like hear about the human cost and what people... Yeah. On the ground thing. Yeah. So
I mean, like the fact that you as someone that isn't Syrian and has access to other platforms, I think it's really important that you use those platforms for that reason. I'm sure the Syrians that you interviewed or the DACA recipients you interviewed appreciated that because they don't have access to platforms like that.
No.
Yeah. Also like a kind of a privilege and an exciting thing for me as an Israeli that sometimes, you know, if you were in Syria and I was in Israel, we weren't able to talk.
Well, you say it that way. That's so, it's true. But like, it's wild to think about.
Yeah, it is. And actually at the time I remember and when I was trying to work in a story and they gave me the Skype or contact information of some like, you know, activist slash warrior inside Syria. And we went on a Skype call, you know, it was pretty much in hiding. So it was like a pretty intense story. But the minute he heard I was Israeli, he got pretty weirded out by that. And, you know, out of respect, I didn't want to push. So we kind of, we hung up very early on. But, you know, because it's an extra risk for him, obviously, to talk to me. And even though I guess I was in New York at the time and I wasn't really, I'm like, I'm doing this for an American organization. I wasn't really thinking about it that way. But
Yeah, both sides are understandable in that way because Syrians are already... Their government is already so corrupt and they know that. And if they speak out against Bashar or his family, like it's jail torture. So I think they're just wary of trusting a country that usually doesn't like them. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I also understand that like you can't change that you're who you are. And I like who you are. So it's like it's complicated.
Yeah. I actually have an Arabic teacher who's Syrian too, and we do this online and he's not in Syria. And he told me how when he started, it was still in Beirut and like Israelis reach out and he was kind of in a weird conundrum. Like first, he never interacted with anyone, but also out of Beirut, it's really risky for him to do that. So anyway, and in my search of like learning Arabic, because I've been studying for years and I'm still pretty bad. You know, I ran into like people from different places and it's a tricky situation because you also want to be sensitive of like not putting anyone at risk or making them feel uncomfortable. So,
well, if you ever want to practice Arabic, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm here because it's easy. Like, I think the best way to learn a language is to talk to a friend or like whatever. That's how I picked up Russian a little bit when I was there. And I'm really bad now. But I think like that's the key is like you're in a place or at the very least talking to someone.
Yeah.
You know? Because the Arabic that is taught is very formal in my experience. And that's not how we talk, really. That's how we write sometimes. That's how, like, media is. But It's not colloquial, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the problem. Like, I studied Fusha for years, basically, exactly, and never really practiced Amiya and never really talked. And also, you know, the most intense learning I've had was when I studied in the university in Israel, and I did history of the Middle East as part of my degree. We studied, like, we had Arabic classes, like, 3 times a week and a lot of homework, but, you know, it was taught by, like, a Jewish, white, Israeli woman who didn't really talk. She just, like, she didn't really talk colloquial Arabic with us. And so it was, like, very, very, very formal Arabic. But also, you know, Arabic instruction in Israel, and there's actually interesting, like, writings about it. It went through kind of, like, a militarization. So I've been learning words like tanks and negotiations and like ceasefire before I learned how to say cat and, you know, living room. Yeah. And just like, I'm just looking around me like, you know, it's kind of the opposite of how you teach like a baby or really anyone a language, where you need to start with like really, you know, like nice everyday things. It also creates a weird relationship with the language, right? If you're like learning, if you're learning like war words. And not like, you know, sweet things like cat. So, I mean, I have a lot to say about like, you know, like learning Arabic in Israel, which is something I experienced for years and years. And I, you know, I have really good basis of like reading and writing for it and like the alphabet. But at the same time, I am very like self-conscious and insecure and weird about trying to actually talk to someone.
You know? I think that's how it is for any language that you're not native in for a while, you know?
Yeah, that's probably true too.
Wow, you're so interesting. That's all I'm thinking about is like, wow, what a layered person. Yeah, I really...
Because I was like, why do you want to talk to me?
No.
I was very nervous.
I mean, again, I didn't know all this about you until 40 minutes ago, but I knew that I wanted to get to know you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I was really worried I'm not going to give you any good content.
I think this is one of my favorite episodes ever. I'm not lying.
Oh my
God. I just really appreciate your perspective.
I'm really happy you reached out because like I've been admiring your tweets. It's like I do very little on Twitter. So it's like retweeting other people and like liking their tweets. And I remember like that like event we're both at and how, you know, you read some amazing poems and I felt like my thing was very... It's very insignificant, but yeah, so I'm very glad you reached out. But I was like, yeah, when we talked on the phone, and I was like, why do you want me on your podcast? I don't think I've ever been a podcast guest ever. I'm only booking guests, so I'm usually
hopefully
the person
it leads to
guests.
A lot of other opportunities. Wow. Yeah, anyway, I'm gonna shut up. I watched the trailer for a film that you made. Yeah, and I'd love for you to just like at least plug it or talk about it.
Yeah, so basically last November of 2020, me and my husband went to a place in Northeast Wisconsin. It's one of these places who like, it's very, very swingy. Like it's Deep Purple, which is kind of how we refer to it. And, you know, they voted for Obama in the past, but then they voted for Trump. So we kind of focus on like those three counties that were blue and now they're red. And this is where Sam, my husband, is from. So we basically went to where he grew up. I think for me, like the interest in this area, I mean, beyond just the election, is that like people talk about politics. I think in that, you know, like I've noticed it with like my husband's family and very different from how I used to. Like they're being very kind of careful, trying to be respectful, like not saying, like you can have a full conversation about like the election and still don't understand who people are voting for and who they support. Like, and I think it's like part of like, yeah, it's the Wisconsin nice thing, but it's also part of like living in this reality where it's like, you know, being very purple and like trying to like, you know, like this person next to you is conservative and this other friend is Democrat and you're just trying to like not offend anyone. It's very different than how people talk about politics in Israel. Like we all know who voted for who. We all argue about it in like Friday dinners. And, you know, as is in other parts of the Middle East, I'm sure it's just like it's very much out there. And so I was interested in that kind of discourse in general. And then when we saw that like this place, you know, voted for Trump, voted for Obama, then voted for Trump. And now there is this like big question mark. And it's actually a pretty crucial place in a pretty crucial state. We're like, let's go there during the election and like find some people who are trying to flip this area back to blue. So we drove there because of COVID. COVID was actually, it was one of the highest places as far as infections rate at the time. Like in this like New York list of like 10 worst places, like three of these towns were there on the list in those weeks. So we had to be really, really careful. It was really hard to film that way and to record audio that way. Yeah, we found like three people that we were really interested in following. One of them ran for state assembly, but also obviously tried to, you know, run. I mean, she ran her own campaign, but also tried to convince people to vote for Biden and Harris. The other man is kind of a former farmer, a farm owner who just took it upon himself up in Brown County. It's what it's called, to like start making signs because like the National Democratic Party didn't send them signs. So he started to do like a whole sign operation. And another person is the vice chairman of Oneida Nation, which is a big reservation between those two counties. And, you know, he's a Democrat. And he always kind of gets involved in primaries of Democratic primaries. But really his bigger mission is like to kind of get out the vote in his own community. So a lot of his efforts is really trying to push people to vote and, you know, promote. I mean, he also helped working on kind of like tribal policies for like he wants to like whoever is going to end up president to really think about Native Americans. And obviously for that reason, he was also very concerned about Trump being president because he didn't really prove himself as an ally to Native Americans. So these are the three people. Sorry, that was a long explanation.
No, it's fine. And the movie is called Swing Country, everybody. Swing Country. We'll find the link. We'll put it in the description for the online festival. Watch it. Support Yael's work. She's really interesting and cool. Where should people follow you on the internet if you want to be followed?
I guess on Twitter, but I'm not very active. It's Yael Even Or, so just in a row, Y-A-E-L. E-V-E-N-O-R.
Perfect. Yeah, thank you so much for
coming
on.
Thank you.
This is Ethically Ambiguous, Ethically AMB on Twitter, and Ethically Ambig, AMBIG on Instagram. I'm Shireen, ShiroHero666 on Twitter, and just ShiroHero on Instagram.
And I'm at Anna Hosnier on Twitter.
Yay! That's it. Bye!
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.